Radio Prague News.
Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has denied speculation that Judge Jiří Vyvadil is to replace the Supreme State Attorney Marie Benešová. A poll suggests that most Czechs think Václav Klaus is doing well as Czech president. And an agency run by a man sentenced for fraud is recruiting Czechs to work as security guards in Iraq. Jiří Vyvadil, a judge of the Supreme Administrative Court, is to become the Deputy Justice Minister as of the beginning of September, Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek said through his spokeswoman on Saturday. The Prime Minister was reacting to speculation in Saturday's edition of the Daily Právo, which said Mr. Vyvadil was going to replace the Supreme State Attorney Marie Benešová. Earlier this week, Justice Minister Pavel Němec called on Ms. Benešová to resign over their dispute over the extradition of the Qatari Prince Hamid bin Abdul Thani, who was sentenced for sex with underage girls in the Czech Republic, but Ms. Benešová refused to do so. On Monday, the Supreme Court complied with an earlier request by Justice Minister Pavel Němec, allowing Mr. Thani to be tried at home, which the Supreme State Attorney Marie Benešová had sharply criticized. A recent poll by the SCNC polling agency suggests that around 77% of Czechs believe that President Václav Klaus is doing well in his office, while some 19% have a fairly negative view of his performance and 4% view him negatively. When the respondents were asked to assess the president's concrete steps, Mr. Klaus received an average rating, the poll found. He was given a positive rating for his performance in domestic politics, representation abroad, relationship to the public, defense of the Czech Republic in Europe, and granting of pardons and awarding honors. Saturday's edition of the Daily Právo writes that an agency recruiting Czech men to work as security guards in Iraq is run by a man sentenced for fraud. The agency, based in the town of Otrokovice in South Moravia, promises the men to be paid $80 per hour in Iraq, but charges fees for mediation and training. According to the Daily, the Czech embassy in Baghdad has no information about a Czech security agency operating in Iraq, and the Daily adds that the man behind the recruiting agency, Vladimír Huněk, was sentenced for fraud earlier this year. At present, there are some 30 mercenaries of Czech origin in Iraq working for foreign agencies. They are mostly former soldiers from special units or the French Foreign Legion. The 6th annual Czech-Slovak Rockfest USA Music Festival has started in Yorkville, Illinois. During the weekend, visitors from all around the United States will be able to see the Czech and Slovak singers and musicians Michal David, Michal Prokop, Luboš Andršt, Jan Hrubý and the bands Horký Žeslíže, Vidiek, Staří Psi, Voice Band and also three US-based bands, Doggy Bag, the CIA from Chicago and the Slovak-American band from Minnesota, 5 Ounces. The popular Czech band Kabát refused to appear at Rockfest after the wife of one of the musicians was not granted a US visa. And finally, a glance at the weather. The weekend should be partly cloudy with daytime temperatures between 22 and 26 degrees Celsius. I'm Pavla Horáková, that's the news.
You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name is Peter Smith. Now, coming up later today, David Vaughan and Pavla Johnsonová will be presenting another Czech books. Please do stick around for that. And also, we'll have another letter from Prague, but we'll kick off today with Mailbox. Yet it's your letters and emails, and it's presented by Pavla Horáková.
Hello and welcome to Mailbox, Radio Prague's weekly program in which we read from your letters and emails. And this one came from our listener Christopher Lewis, who lives in England.
Dear Radio Prague, I noticed in the past few days that while you have a clear signal on shortwave, the audio is terribly muddy and poor. It has only sounded like this for a few days. I don't think that this is a shortwave reception problem. Maybe a transmitter fault.
I forwarded the email to the head of Radio Prague's technical department, Martin Šebek, and he told me he was monitoring the outgoing programs regularly and did not notice any problems in the sound quality. So it appears that the problem is not at our end, but we'll keep monitoring it anyway. Thanks very much for telling us, Christopher. And please, if anyone else has noticed any problems in the sound quality of our broadcast, be it in the United Kingdom or elsewhere, do let us know and we'll see what can be done about it. And our listener, John Boone, who's of Czech descent, has a question about our ABC of Czech program.
I enjoy your programming with the ABCs of Czech, but I would like it more if you could have a downloadable file of the sound file in MP3 format, so that I could listen to it whenever, wherever. I know how to convert the audio file to MP3, but would love it if it were already in an MP3 format, making it easier to print and save MP3 files for aid in learning Czech. Also, I'd like to hear more Czech in the programs as well, but I'm grateful for what there is.
To answer John Boone's first question, I spoke to Radio Prague's internet department about the possibility of having the ABC episodes available also in MP3 on our website. They said it certainly would be possible and they have started working on it, but they say it will take some time, so please be patient with us. To answer the second question, Radio Prague also broadcasts in Czech, so if you'd like to practice your Czech more thoroughly, you can give it a try. The program schedule is available on our internet site www.radio.cz, or you can write to us to english@radio.cz or to our postal address Vinohradská 12, 12099 Prague, the Czech Republic, and we'll send you a printed version of our program schedule. And to change the subject, Edward Turnbull from England sent us this request.
Can you perhaps play a fragment of any work by your distinguished 19th, 20th century conductor-composer Otakar Jeremiáš? Didn't he write the Spring Overture? And was not his father a distinguished composer also?
That's quite right. Otakar Jeremiáš was born in 1892, the son of composer Bohuslav Jeremiáš. He studied composition at the Prague Conservatory and also learned to play the piano and cello. Until 1928, he was a music teacher and director of a music school in the town of České Budějovice. And in January 1929, he became conductor of the Czechoslovak Radio's Orchestra, known as the Prague Radio Symphony Orchestra. Otakar Jeremiáš remained its chief conductor until 1945, when he became the head of the National Theatre's opera. Among his best-known works are the operas The Brothers Karamazov and Endspiegel. He also composed many chamber and orchestral pieces, songs for choir, and he also wrote music to a number of films. The Spring Overture Mr. Turnbull mentioned was written in 1912. Was a taste of the Spring Overture by Czech composer Otakar Jeremiáš, and I'm afraid we only have a minute left to repeat the competition question for this month. Our mystery man for August was born in 1943 in the Canary Islands to a Spanish mother and a Czech father. Reportedly, he was raised on a banana plantation. He began by studying architecture and literature, but abandoned his studies after just a year and moved to Paris in 1968. He moved to London 2 years later, where he worked briefly as a photographer, and then to New York, where he dedicated himself to shoe design. Since the 1970s, his shoes have been synonymous with high glamour and are sought after by many famous people, from celebrities to royalty. Let me remind you that you have only 3 days left to send us your answers to the usual address, Radio Prague, 12099 Prague, the Czech Republic, or english@radio.cz. Till next week, thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you very much there to Pavla Horágová. Please do write in. We always value your comments about our programmes or indeed about life here in the Czech Republic here at Radio Prague. Moving on. Time though now for another letter from Prague, this week written by Stephen Weeks.
The State Institute for Monument Preservation was recently proudly publicising the first stage of its restoration of the interiors of Lednice Castle in Moravia. Lednice was the country palace of the Liechtensteins and, like its Schwarzenberg rival Hluboká, is a huge neo-Gothic affair built to be imperial Austrian versions of Windsor Castle. Despite efforts to keep them intact as museums, both castles suffered under communism. Since 1989, the work on Lednice has been impressive. Now listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the park, with its many romantic follies, has received help from the World Monuments Fund, amongst others. So it was with pleasure that I saw a recent Czech magazine promoting an article within on the newly restored interiors. But the pictures it showed were a shock. They looked like rooms straight out of a Laura Ashley home furnishings catalogue from the 1980s. Plenty of floral wallpapers, the odd oriental rug, actually rather comfy. But Austrian neo-Gothic, not a bit of it. What the restored rooms tell us is how remote the pre-1948 aristocratic life has become, so that no one can really recall enough to reconstruct interiors from a way of life that didn't just gently pass into history, but was butchered into oblivion. Real Victorian interiors were crowded with furnishings, the walls hung in a solid mass of pictures, and were often far from comfortable, in our sense, being used for the variety of starchy, formal rituals that life in clothes you could hardly bend down in, yet alone run free anywhere, demanded. You see, servants did all the bending and stretching. In Britain and France, large numbers of castles and country houses have been preserved with all their contents intact, many of them lived in by their heirloom owners, who remember the palmy days, even if they cannot quite relive them. So furniture is not displayed as in a museum, but as it would be in use. And the functions of the hundreds of rooms in the bigger houses are still either remembered or kept, from the brushing room, where skirts that had trailed in the garden were brushed daily, or the ironing room, where the master's newspapers and banks were ironed crisp and his pocket change washed bright, to the grand withdrawing room, where the ladies would retire after dinner while their menfolk smoked cigars and passed the port around the dining room table, or the state bedroom, where the best bed would be kept in readiness for a visit from the sovereign. Czech castles have lost all this memory. Most of them are just so many empty rooms, and those not lucky enough to be state museums on display, or cram full of confiscated German furniture perpetually in store, were used for anything from prisons to low-grade workshops to cowsheds. In 1946, Russian army trucks backed up to several castles so that whole libraries could be shovelled out of the windows into them. And antique furniture was nice dry wood to burn in the harsh winter of 1947. So, of course, it is good that restoration at a castle like Lednice has started, but it will take more attempts to get it right. The paradox of the communist display of Czech castles, given their anti-bourgeois crusade, was that mainly only impressive and very bourgeois state rooms were open to the public. One or two kitchens were shown, but none of the servants' halls or the garrets under the tiles where they were lodged. It's odd they wanted to show the fairy story and not the social reality. And yet, wherever these service interiors are displayed, as well as grand rooms in other countries, they are always immensely popular.
Stephen Weeks there with this week's letter from Prague. Time, though, now for me to get out of the studio and to hand over to David Vaughan and Pavla Johnsonová for another Czech Books. But quickly, I'll give you a reminder of our address. It is Radio Prague 12099 Prague 2, the Czech Republic, the email english@radio.cz. Please do write in. Anyway, as I said, here comes David Vaughan and Pavla Johnsonová, who are this week talking about publishing in Czech Books.
Few fields can have gone through such radical changes over the 16 years since the fall of communism as publishing. In her research, the academic, sociologist, cultural theorist and feminist Yezhina Shmykalova has shed some fascinating light on the subject, publishing a study that has become a classic of its kind. She's also well known as one of the first people to introduce contemporary Western feminist thinking to the post-revolution Czech Republic. In this week's Czech Books, she talks to Pavla Jonsonova about the fascinating transition of the Czech book market. But she starts her conversation by remembering back to the beginnings of her academic career as an undergraduate in Prague during the deepest days of communism in the late 1970s. Surprisingly, given that those were the days of censorship and social engineering, she feels more than a little nostalgic.
I think that actually we were really very lucky in the 1970s when, I mean by we, I mean people who met at Philosophical Faculty of Charles University, because despite all, you know, the obvious political constraints and ideological brainwashing and so on and so forth, I think we managed to form a group of, shall I say, committed souls of people who really understood each other, who read books together and discussed philosophy and played music and did theater and so on and so forth. And I would say that even paradoxically enough, and now I can say that as a university teacher myself, that those, precisely those constraints of the institution of the university made us to create kind of world on our own, which perhaps was even more authentic and more exciting and formating, if you want, than students have today. But that's perhaps too ambitious hypothesis.
Talking about your professional career, you were one of the first Czech scholars to assert themselves on the international academic circuit. Could you please tell us more about what happened? How did your path unfold after your degree in sociology?
Well, this is quite a funny story, because my sort of long dreamed of and desired postdoctoral fellowship in the United States was a matter of a kind of accident, I would say, because at some point, it was still before the revolution of 1989, I saw a little poster on table of my boss inviting applicants for the American Council of Learned Societies postdoctoral fellowship. Of course, it was sort of spring 1989. We could not dream of going for a postdoc to the United States. Nevertheless, I picked up the flyer because I knew it was going to end up in a garbage can anyway. And very shortly after November 1989, I just wrote them a letter that I'd be interested in, you know, applying for a fellowship. And to my great surprise, a guy came from New York in the spring of 1990 and interviewed me for the fellowship. And I have to say that I was the second Czech scholar who got the ACLS fellowship in the States after 1989, that is almost 20 years after they have already stopped coming to the country. And I ended up at the University of California at Santa Cruz in 1991, I believe it was, which, you know, was an extremely exciting time, because at least for those listeners who are a little bit familiar with the field and with the whole structure of American education, Santa Cruz represents one of the sort of new age universities. And when I was there, most of the big shots, as I like to call them, of contemporary cultural theory and feminist studies were present at the university.
Your major publication so far is a book with a capital B, which was written in Czech. It was published 3 years ago, right? Could you please sum up for us what was the book about?
I followed two agendas in this book. One of them was to introduce a field of book studies to, say, the local sort of wider public, because even though in this country we have a very long history of libraries, history of publishing, this whole new interdisciplinary field of book studies, which is trying to combine both the study of text and as readers as a kind of unified field, I would say, or integrated field, has not been so widely discussed here. So that was my idea, to introduce the whole field of book studies. And the other reason for writing this book was also to try to ask some of these theoretical, methodological questions about the transitional book market of the 1990s.
How do you view the current situation on the Czech book market?
It was really interesting in my mid-1990s, just as an example, right? I did about 40 in-depth interviews with these quote-unquote transitional publishers, that is people, you know, who rushed into publishing after the so-called Velvet Revolution. It might be interesting, although I know that statistical data are sometimes very boring, but in this case I think they are quite fascinating because we have to consider the fact that prior to 1989, there were about 42 registered state-owned publisher in Czechoslovakia, right? And already in sort of late 1990, beginning of 1991, there were over 2,500 registered publishers in this country, right? Which, if you look at the big book history from, say, larger perspective as a European book history of the 20th century or even a world book history of the 20th century, you don't find such a dramatic boom, you know, and spring of subjects or people who want to enter the publishing business.
It's quite incredible, 2,500. And so what has happened to all of them?
Well, quite. You see, that's the problem of doing this research, and one of the fascinating things is that this is one of the estimates, of course, right? And you also have to consider that if we are talking about a certain number of 2,500, 1,500, the thousands in this case doesn't perhaps mean so much unless you really look at the concrete activities of these people, right? So at the moment, which is, I would say, what, mid-2005, of course, the number of people who are actively publishing more than 10 books a year is incomparably lower than that. But I think it's also, it is interesting to see how many people decided to register themselves as publisher, because I think, among other things, it shows this kind of incredible eruption of attempt to share ideas with other people. So according to my theory, in the end of the day, it is not so much important how many books these people published as much as the fact that so many people all of a sudden got the idea, oh, I want to go to publishing business, which is notoriously known for being incredibly unprofitable until you are on the very top of the market.
Well, you mentioned these numbers that are strikingly different before 89 and after. Where do you see the continuity in that?
Well, I think that's really the interesting part of it, because, you know, when you look at, say, the media coverage of the book markets in early the 1990s, if you look at a lot of stuff which has been written about them, there's this, exactly, this kind of revolutionary discourse, right? This idea that, yeah, there was a revolution in publishing, a revolution in print, and so on and so forth. But what I'm interested in, while I go beyond these statistical data, is exactly how did people in concrete situations behaved at the point when they were exposed to these transitional conditions, right? And then when you do, as I mentioned, I did about 40 interviews with the publishers themselves in mid-1990s or late-1990s to ask them to reflect on the way how they were coping with the transitional situations, because, for example, one of the first institutions that completely collapsed, which was the distribution system and also the information on books in print, right, which was before centrally controlled, and all of a sudden, you, if you were a bookseller, you didn't know what was really on the market, right? Because there were no very weak or many, many resources of information, and none of them really reliable. And now, how did people, both publishers, booksellers, as well as the readers, behaved in these revolutionary conditions, quote unquote, was precisely by using their old networks of friends, right, by sort of the word of mouth, right, by, interestingly enough, until mid-1990s, there was a really strong resistance to advertisement, right? You would hear from these publishers who would say, oh, if I wanted to make money, I would go to sell bananas and wouldn't sell books, Right? It was a very commonly heard argument. So on the one hand, there was this need, you know, for publishing texts which were previously banned from publishing and so on and so forth. On the other hand, people who went into the business were for a long time resisting the basic market principles such as advertisement, right? Public readings. A lot of fiction writers would have thought, oh, I'm not going to prostitute in front of the audience. A good book sells itself, yeah? And I think this is the interesting part of this whole project. On the one hand, in the numbers, there is this revolutionary boom of publishing and so on and so forth. On the other hand, it is really an institutional chaos which concrete people in concrete situations have to manage. And how do they manage them? By actually applying some kind of patterns of behaviors which were established years ago and which helped them to survive the communist era as well.
Do you think that there's any particular year that could be described as a turning point in that kind of behavior, revolutionary?
There are people from, say, the Association of Czech Booksellers and Publishers who, and I would agree, who see that turning point sort of mid-90s, second half of the 1990s. So I think it took good 5-6 years to really get people to realize that books are commodities, and maybe specific one, but still commodities.
Pavla Yonsonova was talking there to Yeshinashmi Kalova about some of her fascinating research into Czech publishing and book markets since the fall of communism. That's all we have time for today, but I hope you'll join us again on Radio Prague tomorrow. If you'd like to return to anything you've heard on today's program, don't forget that you can find our programs in both sound and text on our website, www.radio.cz. From me, David Vaughan, and all of us here, bye-bye.